It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Jean Purcell. I'm in for Rob Ferrup. Coming up, our guest says the United States should make a commitment to put an end to Alzheimer's disease.
First, we take a look at a new effort to boost urban gardening in Wisconsin's biggest city. Venus Williams is the executive director of Seed Folks Youth Ministry in Milwaukee and the director of Alice's Garden, and now she's looking to turn a plot of vacant land into an herb garden. She joins us now from our Milwaukee studio. Venus, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me back.
Well, let's hear about the herb garden in Milwaukee. What are your plans there?
Well, we are looking forward to expanding our herbal efforts through Homegrown, which is a City of Milwaukee initiative to turn vacant lots and foreclosed homes into viable projects of growing food and making entrepreneurs out of city residents.
Why herbs in particular?
Because that's my passion.
Uh-huh.
I am already engaged in the growing of herbs and in the making of many herbal products through the Alice's Garden Healing Herbs, which is one of our organizations that we run. But this particular project comes from my desire to create employment, especially for African-American males returning from time of incarceration in the city of Milwaukee. So the proposed land that we are looking at is actually a project that would engage ex-offenders returning to their own neighborhoods and engaging them in herbal production and the healing of both land and people.
Is there something, do you think, that's intrinsically healing about working with the land, about gardening?
I don't think it's possible to heal one's neighborhood or community without paying attention to the land. And what I have found over my couple of decades now of working with people and herbs is that something happens when you're engaged in herbal knowledge and herbal production. So as I look at this piece of property that we are hoping to engage at 27th and Brown in the city of Milwaukee, there are two large vacant fields opposite one another. And what it would mean on this busy strip to have fields of lavender and chamomile, fennel, sage, it brings an aesthetic healing along with the healing of the economy, the healing of broken lives, the healing of opportunity to do something meaningful for those people who are returning back to the city.
Now, you mentioned that this would be in partnership with an effort to help former prison inmates reenter society. Would this be a livelihood for them working in these herb fields?
Yes, that is exactly what we are hoping to do. In a partnership with Project Return, who has been engaging ex-offenders for decades, and as a matter of fact, we shared offices many, many moons ago at Cross Lutheran Church. So it's reconnecting with a former partner who is already engaged in this work to bring livelihood and life back to a population that a lot of people fear or who folks are not always willing to take a risk with. So we are looking at engaging men and women returning to the city and teaching urban beekeeping, the herbal production, hoping to even, pun intended, plant seeds of entrepreneurship so that as people are engaged in the land and meet other people, other farmers, other urban farmers, other rural farmers who are engaged in this work, that they may also see an opportunity for them to claim their own piece of land and to start their own project through Homegrown.
Now, you mentioned that you would love to see at this sort of neglected patch of land, you'd like to see lavender fields and chamomile and sage. What do you think that would signify to you if you lived in the community and all of a sudden you've got these fragrant, beautiful, tended herbs growing in the middle of it?
There is healing that happens. We all know that there's a whole economy built around aromatherapy alone. So to immerse the city with fields of herbs, not just for their visual beauty, but for the inhaling and the exhaling, the healing of the body, is something that excites me even more so than the production of herbal products. So we are also hoping to engage neighborhood residents on these blocks in teaching them how to make the products that we already make, our bath salts, our lip balms, our foot soaks, our herbal oils. So it's taking something that's not really complicated, the growing, the using of land to grow something useful, but to reimagine not just land, but to reimagine the lives of people who live in the city.
Sounds like you think that there is something that affects the actual spirit about working with herbs like that.
No doubt. I am living proof of it. The people who continue to call me and text me now because they have experienced this work and these products and these fresh herbs and are wondering, even now as we are in the deep freeze, how can they access this and when do we grow year-round? Do we have greenhouses? Is there a place where they can come and sit indoors? So we experience this already with the clientele who visit us at farmers markets or who come to Alice's Garden and enjoy our herbal labyrinth that we have there. So there's no doubt, and it's nothing new. I make it clear to people what we are doing and what we are putting forth to expand. It's nothing new under the sun. We've always known the healing power of herbs as tinctures, as people burn, even now when I left home, burning bundles of chamomile and mint stems. So we know that these properties are there. All we are doing is inviting a population who might benefit from this work on many levels to come join us in this work.
Now, I know that you're involved in more than herbs. You've got Alice's Garden up and running, and you've said that you think maybe we've forgotten to show people how to feed themselves. We get the message that we need to help feed people, but not to help them learn how to feed themselves. Is that part of why gardens are so important to you?
Without a doubt. I come into urban agriculture from a ministry standpoint of serving this city through the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America as a lay minister since 1988. And indeed, we have done a really good job of giving food, providing food for urban areas, and especially through our congregations. But we just haven't done as well of a job as providing people with the resources to feed themselves. And that's why I entered fully into urban agriculture, coming from a family who my mother, my grandmothers, my great-grandparents were all gardeners and or farmers. And so I know the power of growing your own food and what it means to feed yourself. Everyone has to eat. And as I always say, everyone should grow something that they eat.
Well, Venus, I wish you luck with your project. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Venus Williams, Executive Director of Seed Folks Youth Ministry in Milwaukee and the Director of Alice's Garden.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, we'll be joined by a Wisconsin poet whose new book, Darktown Follies, is gathering critical acclaim.
Our next guest says the United States can do great things when the nation commits to a cause, and this generation's cause should be fighting Alzheimer's disease. We're joined now by Tom Lavacek, who is the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association of Southeastern Wisconsin. He wrote an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel titled, "The U.S. Should Commit to Beating Alzheimer's Disease." Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me on, Rob.
I want to start with some of the basics here, and one of the basics is just defining Alzheimer's disease. I think intellectually, a lot of us might think we might know what it is. We might have a relative who's had it, or we might have heard something about it or read something about it. From where you sit, how do you define it?
Sure. Well, Alzheimer's disease is a disease of the brain, the most common form of dementia in older adults, and it starts by the accumulation of a protein in the brain called beta amyloid, which basically sort of gums up the works. It cuts off the communication between brain cells and then eventually suffocates brain cells and they die. And it continues to progress until you yourself pass away if you have the disease. So it's a fatal disease, the sixth leading cause of death in the United States right now, which is a surprise to some people. And as I said, the most common form of dementia, dementia being an umbrella term that talks about cognitive impairment that is severe enough to affect a person's daily living. And there's several different kinds of dementia. Alzheimer's in older folks accounts for over two-thirds of all dementias.
Yeah, you mentioned that a lot of people are surprised to learn that it's the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S., and I think that is a figure that surprises people. In terms of numbers, how does that translate out? And then are the numbers, the rate we see here in Wisconsin, any different from the rest of the country?
The numbers that in Wisconsin are pretty similar to the rest of the country and across the United States. So basically, 5.2 million people across the United States with Alzheimer's right now, about 110,000 here in Wisconsin. Those numbers, it's essentially an opportunistic disease of aging, Rob. So if you make it to the age of 65, you will have a 1 in 8 chance, 14% of having Alzheimer's. If you make it to 85, you'll have a 1 in 2 chance, closer to 50% chance of having Alzheimer's. So it dramatically increases with age in terms of your vulnerability to it. But the big deal, it's a big problem that we have right now with those kinds of numbers, but what is happening with the aging of the baby boomers is the real cause for concern.
And those numbers it's that sort of wave of people we see coming towards that age. And as you say, it's opportunistic. And so it's the age that's the factor, and the sheer numbers of people who are behind that boom generation, that boomer generation, is what you're looking at.
Exactly. Yeah. So the front edge of the baby boomers are turning 68 in 2014. They were turning 67 in 2013. I have to change what I say. Turning 68 in 2014 at the same rate, 10,000 people a day are entering the baby, the over 65 age group, 10,000 people a day. And so if nothing changes in terms of the way that we address Alzheimer's in the United States, those numbers that I talked about are going to increase dramatically. The state of Wisconsin, who has done a lot of public health surveying about this issue, predicts that the numbers of people with cognitive impairment in Wisconsin will increase by 68% between where we are right now and just 2035. So, in 21 years, we'll have 68% more people with advanced cognitive impairment due to aging, many of them with Alzheimer's disease.
And this is where the money comes in, because it almost sounds crass to say this, but we are talking some really big dollars here. And as you look ahead, that wave of people, you extrapolate out the costs of that, and they're tremendous. It's amazing, those numbers that we're looking at.
Yeah, and, you don't want to just talk about it strictly from the point of view of dollars, but anybody that's been down this road, I don't know if you or Veronica have had it hit your family, but everybody already knows the personal financial toll that Alzheimer's takes. It devastates family finances. It devastates the finances of the older person and what they might have put away for their retirement years, but it's also bankrupting our Medicaid and Medicare systems. And that's not really hyperbole. We're spending $140 billion a year right now in our Medicaid and Medicare programs just to pay for Alzheimer's care in medical and long-term care settings. And that number is going to increase. You know, there's the two big studies that are out there, the RAND study, which is the one that I was talking about a lot in the article, but even studies that we've done here at the Alzheimer's Association that has that $140 billion number going up to $1 trillion by the year 2050. So, you know, essentially, it would be more than we're spending on all domestic discretionary programs at the federal level at that point. So, it will bankrupt the country in our long-term care systems if we don't do something about this.
Yeah, in your piece, you refer to this as a humanitarian issue, and the financial piece is part of that, right?
Financial piece is part of it, but I think the real humanitarian part of it is that, you know, when I talk to the Alzheimer's researchers, and you know, it's wonderful to be part of the association, which is the world's largest private funder of Alzheimer's research. We're connected to all the top researchers in the world. We have an annual research conference that last year drew about 6,000 researchers to Boston. Almost to a researcher, you hear an optimism that it's really not a matter of if we're going to beat Alzheimer's anymore. It's a matter of when. And it's all about now compressing the timeline. And so, you know, the humanitarian side is, if we can actually do that, why wouldn't we? I mean, if you think about the human suffering that happens for individuals that get this disease, if you think about what happens, you know, to families and kids and grandkids, you know, watching their loved ones go through this, I mean, that's the true humanitarian side. Now, of course, there's lots of good causes and lots of important diseases, but this one, when you have the top scientists saying, you know, we think we could do this if we just really had more of a concerted effort for it. You know, that really makes you pay attention.
And you compare it to what happened with polio, and mm-hmm. you had some experiences with that. And, you know, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in America, that was one of those conditions that affected practically every family you talked to. And now, not so much.
Right, yeah. Now, you know, we do still have, you know, people that wind up with post-polio syndrome if they had polio as a kid. Luckily, I have not experienced that myself. But other than the post-polio syndrome, we have basically eliminated polio in the United States and in most of the developed world. The only places where it still pops up occasionally is places where vaccination programs aren't still being implemented, and usually that's because of civil war or something like that, you know. So I mean, it and there's a long list of things, you know, that are kind of like that are diseases and conditions that we've been able to either eradicate them from happening in the first place, or if they do come along, there's treatments and cures that we didn't have before. And that's really what we're hoping for with Alzheimer's. Whether we could ever cure it is a tough question, but we may be able to prevent it from happening in people that would otherwise be getting it if we could do the right things. So, and if you'd like me to just sort of distinguish between that for a second.
Yeah, that would be helpful because I think a lot of people, you know, they think about getting a vaccine or something and then all your problems are solved, but this is more complicated than that.
Well, it may well be, but here's what we know about Alzheimer's, okay? Right now, the average age of diagnosis in the United States is 73 years of age. And the person is diagnosed in the early to mid stages of the disease usually. I mean, it's become enough where people can't ignore it anymore and can't deny it. And but we know that in that person who's sitting there in front of the doctor at the age of 73, that something was changing in their brain as soon in life as their late 40s, early 50s. These beta amyloid depositions were taking place in the brain. There was subtle cognitive changes that were already happening. Now, by the time the person's in the middle to late stages of the disease, a lot of the brain has been destroyed by this disease. That's why the person can't remember. It's not that they're not trying. It's that the memory center of the brain doesn't literally exist anymore. It's been destroyed by Alzheimer's disease. And nobody's yet figured out a way to regenerate brain cells or to create a new brain for a person. So the strategy to prevent Alzheimer's in the future is to prevent it happening in people that would otherwise be getting it. And scientists are right now working on ways that they can see into the brain and see the disease forming at the very earliest stages of that process.
So is that what you meant before when you said that scientists are optimistic now?
Yeah, because now we have these diagnostic tools so that we're going to be able to, let's say you have 10 people in a room, within a couple years we'll be able to say, well, guess what? I mean, if they're all in their 40s and 50s, let's assume, you know, point to person one and say, you have a high probability of getting Alzheimer's. Person number two, you don't have to worry. Person number three, maybe. And then with the ones that have the higher probability, to be able to get something into them as a treatment and also to encourage them to make lifestyle changes, more exercise, probably changing diet and things like that, the goal is to be able to prevent Alzheimer's from developing in that person, or at least to push it out 5 to 10 years or even more into the future. So this is very much what happened with heart disease, where they found a biomarker, which was cholesterol, and you were able to be assessed to see if you have high cholesterol. Oops, you're a person that might have a really strong probability of getting a heart attack if you don't change your lifestyle and take this statin drug. And now people that can do that, myself included, we have reduced our risk of having a heart attack exponentially.
All right. We got to take a break right now and take time out for the news. We're talking with Tom Lavacek about why he thinks the U.S. needs to commit to fighting Alzheimer's disease. And we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you think the nation should be doing to combat the disease? Should the nation be helping out a lot more financially? Have you or someone you know been touched by Alzheimer's? How has it affected you and your family? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up that conversation and take your calls right after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in today for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in today for Rob Ferret. We'll pick up our discussion now about Alzheimer's with Tom Lavacek. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Our guest is calling for a concerted effort to defeat Alzheimer's, to really take a stab at doing something to make the future for this disease look a lot different than it is right now. How has this affected you? We're taking your calls, as I say, at 800-642-1234. And Tom Lavacek, I'd like to talk about that a little bit, because one of the things you're calling for here is sort of a Manhattan Project for Alzheimer's disease. And what has the funding scenario looked like? Where is the money coming from right now to fight Alzheimer's? And where would you like to see that, you know, how would you like to see that change?
Sure. Great question. So there's basically three pots of money, and I'll just describe them in increasing size. The smallest pot comes from organizations like ours that raise money through things like walks and private donations to fund research, and we're able to fund about $25 million of research a year, which is not insignificant, but still not what it's going to take. And there's other organizations like ours. Then the next level is the federal government, which funds through the National Institutes of Health about $450 million a year in Alzheimer's research funding, a number that has essentially stayed flat or actually lost ground to inflation for about the last 7 or 8 years. And then the largest group of the largest funders of Alzheimer's research is actually the pharmaceutical companies, who take the findings from places like the Alzheimer's Association or the federal government, take the most promising findings and try to develop them into treatments. And they can spend $1 billion easily just developing one drug or trying to, and then have it fail in clinical trials. The pharmaceutical companies, rightly so, are not able to track down every possible lead and fund at $1 billion or more each every possible kind of an approach that might be used. So they work in tandem with us and with the federal government to try to surface the most promising opportunities. So, but that $450 million from the federal government, that's the area that we feel has the most potential to go up. And, of course, everybody wants more from the federal government, and the federal government's in a lot of fiscal trouble, and we know that. But they also have the biggest vested interest because, as I said, they're spending $140 billion a year on Alzheimer's care and treatment. So we're calling to have that go to at least $2 billion in a very short period of time. And the scientists can use it. They can spend it. Right now at the NIH, there's a proposal process. The highest-ranked proposals that come into NIH right now, you know, if you can imagine some getting A's, some getting B's, some getting C's, the group that's in the A's, the top-ranked proposals in the NIH, they're only funding less than 10% of the top-ranked proposals right now. So there is the possibility that the breakthrough treatment is right there waiting to be funded, and we're just not able to get to it. And you put that up against other things that the federal government spends money on, you know, you have to think that it's a wise investment. At least I do.
Do other nations have some of the same issues with Alzheimer's as the U.S.? And if so, would it be helpful to get more than just the United States involved?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's a global war going on against Alzheimer's. And the Alzheimer's Association is actually almost an international organization. As I said, we host that conference that 6,000 researchers from around the world come to. We fund researchers in a number of different countries that are doing promising research. And a lot of other countries do put money into Alzheimer's research funding, too, some at a higher per capita level than the United States does. But nobody is really doing it to the level of like a Manhattan Project, as I put it. I just believe that if we really all committed to this at a much higher level, we could see the breakthrough within the next 5 to 10 years that would make Alzheimer's a preventable disease.
Let's take a few phone calls right now. We've got listeners who would like to join in. And if you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Rob, who's with us from Green Bay. Hi, Rob.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great.
All right, I just had a quick question. As hearing earlier, you were saying that in some of these cases, basically the memory areas of the brain don't exist anymore. And I was wondering, with stem cell research and the things going on with that, how that plays into this whole puzzle, if that would be a possibility in the future for actually reproducing or regenerating these cells that you say kind of disappear or are no longer functioning.
Rob, thanks for the question. And Tom Lavacek, it sounds as though he's a little further ahead than where the research might be right now.
Well, not exactly. I mean, so stem cells, you know, the cells that make up the spinal column and the brain have been the toughest cells to regenerate. And so stem cells are being looked at, especially in the area of spinal cord regeneration. And they have been looked at in terms of brain cell regeneration. There's a couple huge issues there, you know, other than the social issues, you know, around should we be doing stem cell research or not. The issue with Alzheimer's is theoretically it may be possible to recreate a better brain again in a person. However, we accumulate our memories throughout our lifetime. So you could make a more functional person that would still not know who they are. So that's why on stem cell scientists and the extent of the damage that's been done to the brain, scientists have not really looked at that as one of the more promising pathways in terms of Alzheimer's. Instead, what they look at is how can we keep this protein from depositing in the brain, or once it begins to deposit, how can we sort of wash it out so it doesn't gum up the works? I'm obviously way oversimplifying this, but those are the two most promising pathways for research into lessening the effects of Alzheimer's. But as I said, once it's further along, there's pictures on our website of autopsies of brains, of a normal brain at the age of 80 and an Alzheimer's brain at the age of 80, and you can see it's about half the size, literally half the size, because it's just been eaten away by the disease.
Let's take a quick phone call from Mary, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question is, I had a grandmother who suffered terribly from Alzheimer's on my mother's side, and my father, who's about 82, was recently diagnosed with it. Is this necessarily a death sentence for me in terms of guarantee of getting Alzheimer's?
Oh, genetics, yeah. Well, so here's the answer, Mary. So there is one form of Alzheimer's that's extremely rare that is dominantly inherited genetically, just like Huntington's disease is, but it's, as I said, it's extremely rare, and it normally hits people in their 40s, and the progression of the disease is very fast. The person is usually dead within about 9 months. So that probably didn't happen to your parents. The more common form of Alzheimer's that we see in older adults it develops very slowly over time. It progresses very slowly. And in terms of a genetic link, the scientists are only beginning to figure that out. We know that it can skip generations. Having parents who have Alzheimer's, it does increase your susceptibility to getting Alzheimer's yourself. However, it's not causative. It's not like it's guaranteed that if your parents had it, you're going to have it. It can skip a generation. For some reason, it can start in generations where neither parent had it, and one of the kids can get it. So the genetic links we're only beginning to figure out. There's been 11 genes that have been identified so far that are implicated in Alzheimer's disease, but nobody totally understands how that genetic piece works. Someday we will, and it's an important part of the research right now.
Mary was also curious about whether a vegetarian diet would help prevent Alzheimer's, and what is the role of diet? Does anybody know?
Sure. There's a number of things you can do to reduce your risk factors. The main ones are to actually take care of the co-occurring disorders, which are commonly seen with Alzheimer's: diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. We always say if you can control the numbers for that, you're going to reduce your risk. After that, exercise, diet, and keeping yourself mentally stimulated and socially involved are the most important things that you can do. So there's a number of things on our website at alz.org that you can look at that provide more background and more information on dietary changes that you can make that have been found to be useful. We also have a 24/7 helpline, 1-800-272-3900. People can call that and get more information on diet and exercise regimens that have been proven to be helpful. So that's all available on our website and by phone.
Well, Tom, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
And good luck with the campaign. Tom Lavacek is the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association of Southeastern Wisconsin. He wrote an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel titled, U.S. Should Commit to Beating Alzheimer's Disease. This is Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Recently, Wisconsin poet Ahmad Jamal Johnson's new book, Darktown Follies, was named one of the best poetry books of 2013 by Slate Magazine, and it's currently under consideration for an LA Times Book Prize.
Johnson's book focuses on race in America as seen through the prism of history.
Ahmad Johnson teaches in the MFA program in creative writing at the UW-Madison. His book, Darktown Follies, is one we'll be reading from today. Ahmad, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations on having your book named one of the best poetry books of 2013 by Slate. How does that feel?
It's exciting and humbling. Most of creative writing is done in private, you know, closed doors. So it's a delight to have the book.
Did you think, gosh, people are reading it?
Well, you know, it's interesting partly because the audience is invisible. You know, they're few opportunities to really have to get to know poetry readers. So to kind of see a book get that much press so soon is really a delight. So,
well, your book is called Darktown Follies, as we said, and critics have described it as a take on race in America as viewed through the lens of vaudeville and the minstrel show. But how would you describe it?
Well, initially I was interested in jokes that weren't funny. I have a strange sense of humor. So there are ways in which I'm constantly trying to figure out what people find funny in vaudeville, you know, what made people laugh. Humor exposes a great deal of our kind of cultural moment. So thinking about, you know, the nature of racism in that moment and also kind of processing exactly what people respond to pulled me into those poems and think about those particular themes.
So did you go on a historical quest to sort of see what the bread and butter of vaudeville was?
Well, you know, reading sheet music, looking at some of the old video clips, and then just reading a bunch of old gag books really gave me a sense of the tone and just beginning to kind of process exactly what was at stake with some of those jokes.
And can you give us an example of one of the jokes that got you thinking and might have instigated some of the poetry?
Well, many of them were considered conundrums. You know, usually an African-American figure would be put in a situation that he would have to kind of think his way out of. You know, so the process of kind of managing the conflict was the joke. Certain things like he's his own grandfather or he swallowed an egg, which the heart of it was always, you know, violent, or, you know, he's his own grandfather ultimately suggests something about incest, which isn't funny. But to think about those things playing out on stage, yeah, just created some confusion for me. And that was enough to kind of pull me into the poem.
Well, speaking of He Swallowed an Egg, you've got a couple of poems I want to have you read. And let's start with one. You can read, if you want to read He Swallowed an Egg, why don't we start with there, since we mentioned that one?
That's great. He swallowed an egg. Mr. Cleveland, seems like I got this shell nestled up just above my abdomen. Damnedest thing the shopkeepers touch. What you think bring a man into the inspiration to get all cat-like like that? Was whole under the custody of my tongue, then before I know, gone. Say the moon's nothing but blown glass, and God just gone and hit the straw. Say the heavens just like my hands after I've bled the hog good and clean, and stars like barley fanned out across the coop. Here's my predicament, cousin. If I move, the egg will get the lion's teeth. If still, then come all that waiting until that Shanghai rooster begins to claw at my belly, until he starts to itch for air.
Thank you so much for that. And that's an example, it sounds like, of one of the conundrums you're talking about, and it created a reaction in you. You thought about it.
Well, part of it is, I think, beginning to process what it means to move past the joke. Here, I'm imagining the consciousness of that figure, processing something possibly horrible happening. You know, this rooster, you know, hatching in its belly and ultimately killing him. So it's that moment, that hesitation, that helped me to process something about the consciousness of that particular character. And then that becomes the pleasure, building an image system, thinking of, you know, syntax, of vocabulary that would make an imagined figure somewhat real and then turn it inside out, essentially.
Well, along the way, you do draw upon the lives of some famous voices in Black history, in writing, in vaudeville, in film. And for instance, you've got a poem about Burt Williams. Who was he?
Yeah, Burt Williams, you know, maybe he was our Beyonce 100 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, he was the best-selling African-American entertainer, recording star, and, you know, vaudeville stage performer, you know, around 1908 to 1915. W.C. Fields once said about Burt Williams that he was the funniest man he ever met and the saddest person he ever knew. So thinking about the absurdity of African-American comics performing in blackface also pulled me into this particular history. You know, there's an absurdity masquerading people who are masquerading you, essentially, and attempting to kind of outdo them. So Burt Williams was central during that era.
And you've got a poem about him. Do you want to read us that one?
Yeah, this begins with an epigraph from Burt Williams. The man with the real sense of humor is the man who can put himself in the spectator's place and laugh at his own misfortune. Nobody. Bet you showed him, Burt. I mean, got their goat good. The way you pulled that fist of 50s from your billfold and bought the whole bar around. Trace of burnt cork coloring the edge of your collar and your smile sliced wide as a melon's quarter moon. I see their faces outcropped and looming in the darkness, cigar smoke cross-hatching the air, and shadows clustered, all leaning in corners like small congregations of drunks. Light from Lafayette's marquee, Abyssinia, and the red lettering of your name wasn't enough to stop the barkeep's ribbing. Mr. Nobody, you sang. O death, where is thy sting? and you, cakewalking with your eyes, pantomiming something like laughter.
Thank you for that one, too. Did you feel like you got to know these people as you researched them and you thought a little bit about what might have been unfolding inside their heads?
Well, part of, I think, the work of doing historical research is not just thinking about their lives, but almost trying to dream historically, you know, imagining, you know, what they must have read in newspapers, the kind of conversations they had, and, you know, building that sense of intimacy. So then in writing a persona poem, it's not necessarily, you know, simply a performance of voice, but really beginning to think about who they may have been, you know, to establish that intimacy, to then think about these small corners, bits of language, image systems to help create a context for their identity.
Now, in most of the bios that I've read about you, the first line is that you were born and raised in Compton, California. Was growing up in Compton important for becoming the poet that you are?
In some way. I think the understanding of community and culture, you know, ultimately comes back from my time there. I always imagine an audience in certain ways, and I think the writing these poems, I'm constantly thinking about, you know, how they may play, you know, in my family or play with my old friends. So manipulating diction, high and low diction. Also, I think just the political significance of history, you know, always working to create some framework or context for our past. You know, Compton has obviously been, you know, in the news for, you know, for several, you know, decades in terms of violence. I think I've always tried to understand historically and theoretically where that violence comes from. So as a poet, I'm manipulating voices or thinking about narratives to help put something into context for myself emotionally.
I was thinking about how Compton, there's a lot of artists who've come out of Compton as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your book, as some critics have seen it, is sort of your take on the misfires about entertainment and Black culture. Do you see an intersection there?
Well, you know, as a Westerner now, I think there are ways in which seeing California from Wisconsin is interesting because I can really see what entertainment represents there. You know, if you have really cute kids, the first thing that people might say, it's like, oh, they should be in commercials. You know, there's a degree of, you know, materialism that obviously is present in most major cities. I rejected that idea of being an entertainer. I think I always had real questions about what that meant morally, what that meant emotionally. So there are things, I think, that inspired this work, what it means to perform. Are there ways in which we can't avoid performance to a certain extent? So being critical or beginning to really think about what it means to perform versus be aware of you know, our performative selves is really key.
Ahmad, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for sharing your poetry.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Ahmad Jamal Johnson. He's an award-winning poet from Wisconsin. He teaches in the MFA program in creative writing at the UW-Madison, and his new book of poetry is called Darktown Follies. It was named one of the best poetry books in 2013 by Slate magazine.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.